Welcome back to the Dialogue Studio. This podcast series is hosted by the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue. In it, we explore the transformational practice of dialogue and why it is important, especially in this current moment. In these episodes, you will hear from individuals from all walks of life sharing what dialogue means to them and how they are practicing it in their daily lives. We will also introduce our founder, Daisaku Ikeda's philosophy of dialogue and the various approaches and strategies we practice here at the center. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Dialogue Studio. It's hard to believe it's already August, and I hope you are all doing well and staying healthy. You may know that we are starting to transition back to in-person events, and it's been so exciting, and we just hosted our first in-person dialogue nights in July. As we begin to engage with each other face-to-face, life-to-life again, I thought of the perfect person to help us get excited about dialogue and unpack how we can practice it in our daily lives. Our guest today is Dr. Melissa Bradford of DePaul University. Melissa is a professional lecturer in the Department of Leadership, Language, and Curriculum at DePaul. She teaches educational leadership, research methods, and value-creating education, and directs the internship program for Principal, Superintendent, General, and Higher Education Leadership Preparation. Melissa not only teaches at DePaul, she is also a 2018 graduate of the DePaul's doctoral program and brings that experience to her mentorship and doctoral students. In 2008, she founded Tallgrass Sudbury School in Riverside, Illinois, and currently serves as the president of its board of directors. Melissa is a longtime friend of the center and has generously offered her advice to us over the years as we developed our dialogue programs. So I'm so excited for all of you to hear from her and learn from her. In this episode, I talk with Melissa about her personal journey with dialogue, insights from her research on dialogue and Ikeda's philosophy, the importance of dialogue as we look at the condition of our world today, and so much more. Enjoy.
Well, first, I'll just thank you for inviting me. This is such an honor. The work that the Ikeda Center does is so inspirational to me because it's so aligned with the strong passions I have in my heart for helping people to become more dialogic. So it's honestly just an honor to be with you. So a little bit about me. Well, I grew up in rural Michigan. And in a, you know, small communities, small schools. Now I live in the Chicago area and I teach educational leadership, research methods, and value creating education at DePaul University. Throughout the course of my life, I've been connected to education. So I taught eighth grade for a while. Then I founded a school. It's a school that's run democratically, K-12 school, but it's very unorthodox. All the ages are mixed together and, you know, students make all the rules together with the staff. And that is probably one of my biggest passions, in addition to dialogue, is, you know, studying this kind of school, talking about this kind of school, thinking about how this kind of school might inform how we do education, because there is a lot of dialogue that happens at a democratically run school, and it's very exciting. Mm.
Well, thank you so much, Melissa. I've forgotten how sort of interesting your life is. And I think we could do maybe different podcasts, like maybe one on education and one on something else. And we always have such great conversations as well. So thank you for sharing that. And of course, today we're sort of honing in on this idea of dialogue, this one aspect of your life, which I'm sure sort of permeates other aspects as well. Yes. But truly, I think when I think of dialogue, I think of you, Melissa. You're like one of the faces that pop up in my mind. And I mean, not only are you teaching dialogue at DePaul, as you shared, and you're also doing a lot of research on dialogue. I'm sure it comes into your work as an educator. Your dissertation was titled Friends in the Orchid Room, An Inquiry into Value Creative Dialogue, which was so fascinating and encouraging to read, especially for us at the center who are always trying to really practice and apply Daisaku Ikeda's philosophy of dialogue. And I would love to ask you more about that in a little bit. But first, I've always wanted to ask you, Melissa, like, why dialogue, you know, and how did you sort of become interested in it in the first place? Yeah, if you could share a little bit about that.
Well, interestingly, my interest in dialogue, it came from the fact that I was not very dialogic earlier on, and it really caused problems. And I think how I became alerted to this was that I had begun studying Mr. Ikeda's work for, you know, probably I was in college, so it was 35 mm-hmm. years ago, and I was just reading about his ideas of transforming within, what he calls human revolution, and how important dialogue is. And I had a great intellectual understanding of it, and I was like, yeah, that's right, I'm on board. But when I started my democratically run school, all of a sudden, things were very different. So I had taught eighth grade prior to that, and I was the cool teacher doing fun things with my students, and they loved me, and whatever I said was kind of how things went. And when I shifted to a democratic school, all of a sudden, people didn't take everything I said just because I said it. And I would get really upset because I would think, well, obviously I'm right. Why aren't you listening to me? Why aren't you agreeing with me? And it got very tense and just didn't know what to do. And so I was talking to a friend of mine and, you know, the ongoing saga of, you know, the frustrations I was feeling at my school where, you know, if I couldn't convince people of my way, then too bad, it didn't go my way. And, you know, she would tell me, it's not 25% you, it's not 50% you, it's 100% you. And I thought, what are you talking about? You know, clearly I'm right. Didn't you hear all the stuff I just told you? I'm right. And what she was trying to tell me, but and it took a very long time for me to understand this, was that it doesn't matter if you're right. You have to win in the situation. And being right doesn't equal winning. So it took a long time, but I really, you know, kept going back to what Mr. Ikeda says about dialogue. And I'll just give you an example of one quote that kind of helped me. He said, dialogue is not some simplistic assertion of one's own position, nor is it necessarily about persuading others to one's point of view. Dialogue is about demonstrating respect for another's life and being determined to learn when confronted with difference in personality and perspective. So this was a big shift for me because I was so used to, I need to tell everybody what I think about this and somehow convince them. And so to think about shifting to listening, to understanding others, to try to really respect each person and be open when we had differences, I just had never learned that. You know, we don't really teach that in school. School is about being right, you know, not making mistakes. And I had to really grapple a lot with that. But eventually I got it. Eventually I let go of this need to be right and this need to have things my way. And it was just a deep, deep shift internally in me. And then that just allowed me to be so different, to comport myself so differently with the people around me. And interestingly, I started having much better friendships, you know, much better relationships in my family because I realized, oh, it's okay. You're not threatened when somebody disagrees with you. It's just something interesting that you can explore and be curious about. And I will say, once I was able to let go of all of that, I became a much happier person.
Wow. Thank you so much, Melissa. I was just thinking as you were sharing that, it's so beautiful that your intro or your interest in dialogue started from this kind of struggle you had with yourself and with others. And it really reminds me of Mr. Ikeda's philosophy of how dialogue is this way of being able to transform ourselves and to become fully human. So it's so wonderful that that's how the journey with dialogue really started from you. And I cannot imagine when you started out by saying, oh, I became interested in dialogue because I was not dialogic. Like, I was like, what is a not dialogic Melissa look like? Like, I can't picture that. But I'm sure it's sort of this ongoing journey that you've had.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, you know, this maybe is a good segue to this next question in terms of like the relationship between dialogue and inner transformation and inner work. And I think prior to working at a dialogue center and encountering Mr. Ikeda's work, I had never thought of like dialogue as a form of self-improvement or of almost in your experience, like happiness. I just had never made that connection. And I think sometimes it's really hard to make that connection off the bat. And so was it surprising for you to see the connection between, wow, like when I really practice this kind of dialogue with others, how did it lead you to these moments of self-reflection and growth that you experienced over the course of, I don't know, the last however many years you've been on this journey?
Well, I feel like from that moment, it has been a constant process of transformation. Because every time I am, it's not like I'm never confronted with something that upsets me or makes me want to go back into that that argumentative I'm right mode. I confront it still, especially if I'm watching the news. But I constantly remind myself and think one more time, okay, how can I expand myself? Mr. Ikeda calls it bringing out your greater self. So your lesser self is really attached to your ego and your own personal kind of perspectives. But transforming or bringing out that greater self is that self of connection with others, with the universe, really. Mm. And so it's a state of being where you just orient yourself very differently to everything, to the world, to your colleagues, to your family. And so whenever I face that kind of challenge again, I just go back and say, okay, how can I be dialogic in this moment? And if I can't be dialogic in the moment, I might step away or I might talk to someone who will, like my dissertation chair. I still talk with him and say, oh, I'm so upset about this. And, you know, he'll lend a sympathetic ear, but then he'll kind of remind me, you know, you're better than this. You don't need to get sucked into your ego. Mm,
that was so helpful, Melissa. Especially I love you pausing to ask yourself, like, how can I be more dialogic in this moment? And I think that just breaks down a little bit for me, like what that moment to moment engagement with dialogue looks like when you are faced with a challenge that might, yeah, seem just impossible to move forward in. And yeah, I mean, it sounds like too that it is a practice, like you have to do mm-hmm. it over and over and mm-hmm. over and over again, mm-hmm. Which is yes. encouraging and also can be, you know, daunting sometimes to think that it's a sort of this lifelong thing. You mentioned your dissertation chair, Melissa, and even your dissertation was a very dialogic process in and of itself. Mm. So I was wondering, and I know in it, you did this incredible sort of deep dive of Ikeda's dialogue books, and then you had a dialogue partner that was very much part of your dissertation too. And so I was just wondering if you can speak a little bit more about that whole experience and any key sort of takeaways.
Well, it was another transformative experience. Education can really transform you. And I will say when I went into a doctoral program, I wasn't really expecting to be transformed at this point. I'm like, oh, you know, I've at this point in my life and my career, I've got it all together. I have a lot of answers. But being in that educational space really opened my eyes again to many things. And I didn't know what I wanted to do for my dissertation, but I had already connected with my dissertation chair, Jason Gula, and he is a real expert, probably the foremost scholar in the English-speaking world of Ikeda's work. And so we had many talks, and I shared my interests, and he picked up on the fact that dialogue was so important to me. And over time, he said, well, what do you think about using dialogue as a methodology for your research? And I thought, what would that even look like? How could you use dialogue as a research methodology? And again, really opened my eyes, and I did a lot of investigation. There wasn't a lot out there. And I thought, you know what? I'll just create my own methodology. So at the same time, I had connected with another student of Dr. Gula, and we met one time to talk about some scholars of dialogue at a little hamburger joint. And we just talked and talked and talked. And next thing you know, I look at my watch. It had been 5 hours. Wow. We were sitting there in dialogue. And over then, we just got so much out of it. We kept meeting and having dialogue about education. You know, we were so different. He was teaching in a public school in an urban setting. You know, I had this private school experience. We were bringing such different things to the table. But at the same time, we had shared interests of understanding Ikeda's work, understanding dialogue, and thinking about how you practice dialogue in an educational setting. So at one point, Dr. Gula said, oh, maybe you should start recording these dialogues. I'm like, okay. So I started recording them. But then now what do I do? Okay, I have all these recordings and I'm interested in dialogue. And then he said to me, my chair, what about looking at Ikeda's published dialogues? He's published so many book-length dialogues, more than probably anyone ever has. I mean, this is very interesting that he has done this. Why do you think he does this? What comes out of it? Why publish a book that's written as a dialogue? So I started reading Ikeda's dialogues. I got my hands on 40 of them in English, and I went through each one and I looked for how they had dialogue with each other, how often each person talked, was it kind of an even exchange, what kind of rhetoric did Ikeda use. I identified something called invitational rhetoric, which is from scholars Foss and Griffin, and it's kind of a feminist perspective on rhetoric where instead of trying to really persuade people to your perspective, you just invite them. And they can choose to engage or understand your perspective or not. I really loved that idea. It was much more dialogic of, yes, I just invite you. I'm not here to persuade you. And so so I looked for that in his dialogues. And I looked at what he said about dialogue with his dialogue partners. And from all of that, I understood that dialogue that creates value for Ikeda is a dialogue where each interlocutor discovers their shared values, which are the values of humanity. And they're not finalized. They're always in discovery and in discussion where you're finding your shared values. And then at the same time, it doesn't mean that everybody has to agree or be the same, you know, because Ikeda is also very, he stresses very much respecting diversity and individuality. And so he says, you can appreciate your differences, find where you disagree and think about what's, or at least how you look at life differently and think about what you can value in that. You know, there were a lot of other insights I got from the study, but I think that idea that value creative dialogue is both discovering your shared values with someone and appreciating your differences. I thought that was pretty meaningful.
Wow. Thank you, Melissa. I have so many questions that I promise I won't ask you all in this one podcast. Wow. I do have two questions based on what you just shared, Melissa. One is when we talk about why dialogue, we often share that for Ikeda, dialogue is really the surest path to peace. You know, that through dialogue, we can really create a better world for us at this time. And so I was just wondering if in your process of doing your dissertation, did that come up at all for you? Like, did you feel more hopeful about, I'm sure there are so many things happening in the world as you were doing your dissertation and engaging in these dialogues and studying and analyzing Ikeda's work. Like, did it translate into your personal feelings about the world at the time?
Yes, I would say so. Because another thing that Ikeda talks about is a life-sized paradigm of change. He says when we look at all the injustices, the problems, the issues systemically, they feel so big and overwhelming that we feel powerless. So he says we have to look at change from a life-sized perspective. And in my dialogues with my dialogue partner, my interlocutor, Michio, I saw how he was changing things in his classroom based on our conversations. Mm. And he shared that journey with me. I volunteered in his class so I could kind of see the really wonderful, exciting things he was doing in his classroom. And it was just a constant process of growth and new ideas. It was just very exciting. So when you think about this life-size scope of making change, I saw change in his life, and I know how much I changed and grew and just felt more connected in the world because of our own individual connections. So I see how that little bubble of change can then spiral outward. Him with his students and his parents and his colleagues. Me, I've taken all of this and turned it into publications that other people can read and think about it. And I've been able to implement it in some of my classes. And it's been so fun to see how my students get excited about these ideas and try implementing them. And they're also seeing change. So yes, that makes me hopeful. So I try not to focus too much on the big issues. Of course, I see them. Of course, I want them to change. But I think I'm really in Ikeda's camp where I say the change has to come from you first as an individual and then connecting to those people around you.
Mm. Yeah, thank you, Melissa. As you were responding to the question, I realized that, well, because of your dissertation, we did this whole dialogue project at the Ikeda Center. And then we put a forum on titled "Can Dialogue Save the World?" So, you know, it's like, duh, Lillian.
Connections.
Of course, you know, just the thinking about the ripple effect and then just the confidence you feel that, wow, if I can have a connection with this person, maybe there's all these other people that I'm also able to have similar connections with, like the relationship you built with Michio, you know. Yeah, that's so beautiful. And kind of relating to Michio and the first meeting you both had, 3 hours, I don't know how many hamburgers later.
That's right.
This is going into our next question, which is, I'm sure when you guys met, I imagine it wasn't like, this is a dialogue. And, right. You know, you were probably just connecting and, you know, having conversation. And this is something that comes up a lot at the center is like, okay, well, am I having a dialogue now? What constitutes a dialogue? And did you and Michio sort of have this shared understanding? Like, we are engaging in a dialogue now. And related to that, how would you differentiate the kind of dialogue you are really practicing and teaching and researching versus like any other conversations that we might have in our own lives?
Well, something I'm realizing is there's a difference between being dialogic and having an intentional dialogue. So I brought in my dialogic kind of way of being with Michio. And in that first conversation, we definitely had some differences. And they could have easily become clashes. Like if it were the old me, we would have had some arguments right there. Okay. And I would have been defensive and tried to convince him he was wrong about something. I didn't do that because I understood that it's okay. I'm just going to listen with an open heart and maybe I'll learn something from what I disagree with him about. And I think that that made a big difference. You know, Michio, I don't know, I can't speak for him, but I think through our process together, we became more and more dialogic. But conversations meander, right? Sometimes you wander into discussion or debate, or it's just a meandering conversation. So it's fluid. It's not like, you know, somehow you switch a switch and then you're doing dialogue. But you can do intentional dialogues, which I think what's been very interesting for my class and something I would definitely share with your listeners is there's something very helpful, maybe, or just meaningful when you approach someone and say, I want to talk to you, but I want to use dialogue. And here's what dialogue means. Dialogue is not debate where you're thinking about your own perspective and trying to convey it. Dialogue is not discussion where you're both just kind of talking. But dialogue is where you're really trying to see through the other person's eyes. So it requires a big shift, you know, in your disposition toward the other, where you're thinking, like Ikeda says, I love this one quote. Ikeda says, listen to the other person's inner voice.
Wow.
How do you listen to someone's inner voice? Think about it and challenge yourself to do that. And I also talk with my students about inquiry and advocacy. So when you're confronted with a difference, see if you can shift mode to being curious, to asking questions. If you want to argue back, pause and say, okay, let me think if I can phrase something to you as a question. And then advocacy is, dialogue doesn't mean you have to roll over and just give up all your own values and convictions. You know, it means that you find ways, like you kind of pull deeply from within you the words to encapsulate what's going on inside of you without it being sort of a, you know, I'm telling you this because you're wrong and I'm right. It's more like, okay, like I'm really searching inside of myself to express to you the way that I'm reacting right now and explore it together with you. So being able to do that, I think these are definitely skills you can practice for sure. You will get better at them. If you do intentional dialogues, you know, my students have chosen sometimes some really, really hard dialogues. You know, I want to talk to my brother about the way I came out to him 2 years ago and how he reacted, because it was a very bad experience and I'm going to take it on. And, you know, I want to talk to my father about our difference in politics. I want to talk to my mother about our difference in religion. I mean, these are hard things to talk about, but I want to do it as a dialogue. And this is what a dialogue is. And, some students have reported back that they were profoundly transformative for them in their relationships. So there you go. Intentional dialogue, but also developing within yourself a dialogic disposition.
Wow.
There were so many moments.
I was like, when you said, how do you listen to someone's inner voice? I was
inner
like,
voice.
You just blew my mind on so many levels, Melissa. Yeah, thank you for sharing about your students, you know, who challenge themselves to take on these hard dialogues or difficult dialogues, because that was one question that I had that I think maybe we've even talked about, Melissa, is every dialogic person I know, I feel like has a certain level of like self-awareness and a willingness to change or to want to self-improve. And so I always wonder, like, can it be a dialogue if, you know, and I'm thinking about there's one person in my life, I guess, maybe I'm like, this is my chance to get advice from Melissa. But you know, that she often says to me, like, I don't want to have dialogue, you know, like, why do I have to dialogue about everything? I just want to, you know, take it easy. And so I always think, like, can I still have a dialogue with this person? And can I still have this transformation within my life, even if this person is not dialogic and doesn't really, you know, respond in the way that is like, oh, they changed. Like, can I still experience the power of dialogue almost on my own? That makes sense.
In some ways, it might be the best way to experience dialogue, interestingly. Because of how much it will challenge you. So when you have a dialogic disposition, you may not always decide to just spend a lot of time listening and listening and listening to someone who is not dialogic. But you can when you feel like there are differences that need to be worked out somehow with this person, you can always go back to inquiry and advocacy. You can ask them questions. You can be curious. I found it very interesting how, in some cases, when you ask the other person a lot of questions, at some point, they say, well, let me ask you a question. And then there are cases where it may be 15 years before the other person says, let me ask you a question. So, but the thing is that dialogic relating really, in my opinion, is the ultimate reality of the world. We live in the world. We are answerable to everything around it. Even if we don't answer, that's an answer. So no matter what happens, we are in dialogue. People can't not be in dialogue, honestly, unless they're completely closed off to the world. So, you know, you have to use your discretion. When is time to really push for the dialogue? And when is it time to just, wait it out and wait for the moment? Sometimes you just wait for the moment and then suddenly the door opens and then you can connect. But regardless of how they respond, you are still growing. You're getting better. You're expanding. You're accessing your greater self. So yes, I think you can have dialogue no matter what.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you. Yeah, listening to you, I'm thinking a lot about it even differently now after so many conversations around dialogue. Like sometimes I think I end up focusing so much on the dialogue itself. Like, oh, this conversation feels like a dialogue versus really what you said earlier about being dialogic versus the dialogue. Like it's really about me as a person in the process of becoming versus like, oh, this is the result. Here, we had a dialogue. Right.
You know, I'm glad you said that because many scholars say that dialogue has no telos. It has no end point. So it's never finished. Mm. You're in dialogue until you die. And there's never a conclusion. There's never an end point. And that's a hard kind of thing to maybe get comfortable with. Mm. So realizing there's not a point to the dialogue in the sense of like, you know, we're going to get somewhere. You don't know where it's going to get. It's totally uncertain. It may completely surprise you. I've had many dialogues and probably you have two where you think, wow, I didn't think we were going to go there. But then there you are. And so that's what dialogue is. So kind of part of the letting go is even letting go of sort of expectations of a particular outcome.
Mm. Yeah, that's so helpful. Thank you, Melissa. Sort of in the realm of difficult dialogues, you probably have heard this or experienced this yourself, but with the pandemic in the last 2 years, like just connecting and engaging with each other has looked so different in good ways, but maybe also in ways that where it's easier to isolate. And I think many people have shared the struggle of really being able to connect and how much harder it is to put yourself out there. Mm-hmm. We actually just had a dialogue nights last Friday on relationships and how challenging those have been. And I don't know if I shared this with you, Melissa, but at our last virtual youth dialogues, we had asked everybody at the end of the event to write down on a piece of paper one person they couldn't imagine having a dialogue with. And then we were going to walk through this process of like, how do you go about engaging with this person? And, you know, when we came up with this activity, it was like right around the time of the shootings. And so I think we were thinking about like certain politicians or, you know, but we did a round of share back and we had about maybe five people share, and everybody shared a family member. It was like my father, my sister, my mother, my father, you know, and it was just so shocking to me, you know, that it's the people closest to us, you know, that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I think that was just really eye-opening for us. But yeah, has just the way you think about dialogue and your work during this time, are you thinking about it differently? And Have you had any experiences yourself in the last 2 years?
Yes, I have had experiences. Maybe first I'll talk about the challenge of connecting. You know, when Ikeda talks about becoming a global citizen, he talks about wisdom and compassion, which I think is typical of what you might think of a Buddhist perspective, right? Oh, the Buddha is so wise and so compassionate, filled with compassion, right? But I think it was Dr. Gula who pointed out to me, Ikeda adds courage to those three, maybe you call them virtues. So courage is the key. We can have all these lovely ideas, but until we act upon them, we can't make anything change. So you do have to really well up your courage. And I've had occasions where I had the most difficult conversation that I knew I had to have. And in my heart was like, no, I can't bring it up. I mean, I am agonizing, right? I can't sleep all night. Like, I can't bring this conversation up. But I had to well up the courage. And somehow I found a way. And when I opened up to this person about what I needed to talk with them about, their reaction was so unexpected. And I felt this profound wash of appreciation for the other person. Like it hit my body I felt it from my head to go all the way down to my toes. Suddenly I felt such appreciation for this person. And I thought, wow, I'm so glad I summoned up the courage to address this instead of suffering in silence. So, but you can start small. Sometimes it's just saying hello to the grocery clerk. Sometimes it's, just a simple reaching out. And so then to connect it to my experiences during the pandemic, as soon as we shifted over to virtual teaching, I knew that I needed to find other ways to connect to my students because I didn't have that in-person opportunity. And of course, when you're teaching face-to-face, you've got your breaks, you've got before and after class and sort of informal things that happen. People are in groups and you chit-chat with them. And so you can't do any of that in a virtual setting. So I took an idea from Dr. Inukai at DePaul. She required all students to have a 15-minute appointment with her in the beginning of the class. And I thought, that's brilliant. So I did the same. And I'm so glad I did. The students always react very positively. Sometimes we go beyond. Sometimes we talk 30 minutes, 45 minutes, right? But at least having that open two-way conversation where the student can feel like I'm approachable, I'm a real human being, I want to listen to you. And sometimes, you know, students will text me. Students will ask, hey, can we Zoom next week? And I try to always clear my schedule for those kinds of conversations because I value them so much. And so I've gotten so much out of those connections with my students. So it's very hard. And I know that people are really struggling, whether it's just connecting or having difficult conversations. And all I can say is really do your best to summon up your courage and to just make even the little efforts.
Yeah, I love that you brought up this idea of courage, because I think it really acknowledges that it's never necessarily easy. And there is this resistance that you, just the way you described it, I was recalling moments in my life where it's just, maybe not moments, like every day, like, no, I don't want to go on to this meeting, or like, no, I don't want to talk to so-and-so, but just a little courage, like you said, and just what you don't expect to find on the other end of that. So definitely, that's so helpful, I think, for me, and I'm sure for everyone listening, especially as we maybe have more of those opportunities now as we're going back to more in-person events, to have to well up the courage in those moments to say hello or, you know, ask someone, how are you doing, beyond just like, okay, talk to you later. Yeah, I really, really love that. I was having a conversation with my colleague today on Zoom, and we were only meeting for like 20 minutes or so. And because it was such a busy day, I sort of was thinking we would just go through the, you know, checklist of things. And yep. She's so wonderful. You know, she just, ask, how are you doing, Lillian? And mm-hmm. and then we ended up spending maybe 15 minutes just talking about how her move has been, how my life has been. And then we finished everything we needed to finish in 5 minutes. But I learned so much about her in that short amount of time. It was really wonderful. So it was just a great reminder of, yeah, the time we need to take to really just pause and talk with each other. As you shared at the beginning of the episode, when you turn on the news, right? I feel like it's such a daily struggle between having hope and then despair and hope and despair. And so I'm just wondering, from the lens of your work and your life and just looking at the condition of our world right now, how does dialogue sort of fit into everything? And what can it offer us in this time when I think we've tried many different things that have not necessarily worked so well for us as a society?
Change, real change, fundamental change, takes a long time. Inner transformation, you know, is a journey that each individual can undertake. And the more people that go on this journey of becoming dialogic, the more it will spread. But it is hard right now because that's not really our cultural understanding here, at least in the United States. I can't speak for other places, but I think that's why I'm an educator, because education is one way to share a different way of being with others. And I do think that it will spread. You know, I see other people talking about this. And I think when we experience problems or difficulties in society, that's when some of us will realize maybe we need to do things a different way. And, you know, and so I think I know I can change. So if I can change, other people can change too. And we have seen change. People will, you know, scholars, when students bring this up, will point to, for example, how much things have changed toward the LGBTQ community. You know, I mean, when I was a child, oh my gosh, so different. I remember in high school when a couple of teachers got found out that they were gay. And I mean, they were fired immediately. It was a big scandal. Things have changed so much. So things can change. And we have to remind ourselves, I can change. That means other people can change. That means society can change. But it does take a long time. Ikeda is a gradualist. You know, he says it's not like a violent revolution is not going to change everything if people's hearts have not changed, if they still conduct themselves the same way, if they still believe in, you know, authority-based ways of conducting themselves, if they still believe in debate, if they still believe in coercion, then it doesn't matter, like, what the system is. So, again, I'm on the same page with Ikeda that it's about education and the slow process of touching other people's lives and all of us, you know, collectively making a shift.
Thank you, Melissa, for the reminder about change as well. Like as you were sharing, I was thinking, oh, whenever I feel hopeless, it's when I think, well, this will never change. You know, this person will never change. I will never change. You know, and then just thinking about, I think dialogue is one of the things that I always find myself thinking, like, oh, wow. You're always surprised when you really have a dialogue, right? Like, you're surprised at yourself and the other person. And so it just, as you were talking, all the dots started connecting. So thank you so much for that. This hour, Melissa, just flew by. I was like, wow.
Yes, it did. That's because I talk so much.
No.
I talk about listening and then I'm blah, blah, blah.
No, this is, we've invited you here to talk, but it's truly been a dialogue because I feel so refreshed and I didn't feel like it was long at all. But just as we sort of wrap up our episode today, unfortunately, we always end with just offering a piece of advice to our listeners, especially those of us who are challenging to have difficult conversations or just trying to connect more deeply in general. Yeah, what's something you would share with them?
What would I share? I guess I'll share a quote from Ikeda. He says, without dialogue, humans are fated to walk in the darkness of their own dogmatic self-righteousness. Dialogue is the lamp by which we dispel that darkness, lighting and making visible for each other our steps and the path ahead. So I would say that a dialogue is for both you and the other. You'll both grow. You'll both be so glad you did. I don't know about you, Lillian, but I know when I'm able to have that dialogue, I feel like I'm floating on air afterwards. I just feel so light and happy and connected and relieved. So it's an easy thing to do on one hand, you know, it's just have a dialogue. Yes, it's also very hard, but I do think that it will be the thing that can help you light the path both for yourself and for the other person.
Thank you, Melissa. I wish we could just take that and then play it every time we need to convince someone to have dialogue. But hold on a second. Let me play you this clip from Melissa Bradford. So thank you for wrapping up this episode so beautifully. And that was such a wonderful quote. I hadn't heard that one in a really long time. So thank you for sharing it with us.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Of course, this is an absolute delight to talk about something that I care so much about. So I definitely appreciate the opportunity and I appreciate you.
As always, I learned so much from Melissa and I hope you all were able to take away something as well. A few things really stood out to me. Genuine dialogue, or value creative dialogue as Melissa called it, is both discovering your shared values with someone and also appreciating your differences. Also, dialogue is not debate or discussion. Dialogue is where you are really trying to see through the other person's eyes, or in Mr. Ikeda's words, listen to the other person's inner voice. Finally, I love when Melissa said that dialogue is not about the result. There's no end point. It's about the person we are becoming in the process of engaging with another, bringing out more wisdom, courage, and compassion in order to connect with the person, for example, and because of that, we are able to transform ourselves. Melissa shared something during our conversation that I personally want to test out, and I hope maybe you'll give it a try too. She said if there's someone in our life who we feel is difficult to engage with, we could approach them and say, "I want to talk to you, but I want to use dialogue, and here's what dialogue means." And often she's found that people experience profound transformations in their relationships. I look forward to reporting back to everyone, and please share your stories with us too. So thank you for tuning in to the Dialogue Studio today. I hope you enjoyed my dialogue with Melissa, and if you want to learn more about her work, we included some links in the episode description. If you are interested in learning more about the Ikeda Center for Peace, Learning, and Dialogue, you can visit our website at ikedacenter.org or follow us on social media at Ikeda Center. Also, don't forget to email us at podcasts@ikedacenter.org if you have any questions or would like to share any of your dialogue stories with us. Stay tuned for our next episode, and until then, happy dialoguing!